Hey, everybody, it's Steve Baker. It's time for another 5 and 10. Sorry I haven't been here for a few days, but I have been in D.C. doing a couple of, well, what I think are important things. But before I get started, please don't forget to like this video. Please follow the Rumble account wherever you listen to this on any of the major podcast platforms. Please like, share, give it a 5-star rating wherever you can do that. All of those things really help. Okay, let's get going. Number one, as I said, I just spent the last few days in DC, and I mention this somewhat frequently in my private locals group, but I hate traveling to DC and not being able to carry my gun when I'm there. Like most responsible gun owners, I'm very careful about following all the laws related to firearms, and especially when I'm traveling. And in my frequent travels, that requires me to constantly look up state and local regulations related to firearms carry restrictions wherever I'm at, including how they have to be kept and stored in your vehicle, even if you're just passing through a particular state or city. In DC, it's particularly frustrating because even though I almost always stay across the river at a hotel in Arlington, Virginia, I never know when I might actually have to drive into DC. That said, most of the time I'm able to Uber across and it's not really a concern. But why do I bring this up? It's hard to imagine, but it's a very interesting news story that came out a couple of days ago. The Mexican consulate in Washington, D.C. has issued a warning to Mexican citizens and expatriates that are living there about the surging crime rates in Washington, D.C. itself. In a tweet, just as I said a couple of days ago, the Mexican consulate said, "Attention Mexican community, the city of Washington, D.C. is experiencing a significant increase in crime in areas previously considered safe. Take precautions. In an emergency, call 911. Interestingly, data that has just come out from the Metro D.C. police, as of yesterday, July 26, shows that there have been 138 homicides in the city, which is a 17% uptick from this same time last year, and that there's been a further 24% increase in sex abuse incidents and a 61% hike in robberies, as well as an overall increase of 37% for total violent crimes just in the last year. Considering the nature of the stories that I'm working on when I'm there in DC and the specific agencies that I have obviously been talking about and targeting for weaponization issues against the American people, I don't dare take any risks. Just before I pulled out of my North Carolina driveway here, I think it was 2 trips back to DC, I suddenly remembered that I had left 2 17-round magazines loaded with hollow points in my car, both of which would have earned me a couple of felony charges in the District of Columbia if a certain department decided to pull me over and search my car. Ironically, but of no mystery to those of us who understand, the cities that are the most dangerous and where we have the most need for personal protection of that type are the areas where it's almost impossible to legally carry unless you go through an incredible permitting process as a resident there. And how ironic is it that the Mexican government itself is warning its former citizens to be extra vigilant in our nation's capital? Number two, we now have a pretty good idea of why the Hunter Biden plea deal fell apart yesterday. It's complicated, but not really. This is the punchline, and I got this from Will Scharf, a former federal prosecutor. He says that typically, if the government is offering to a defendant that it will either drop charges or decline to bring new charges in return for the defendant's guilty plea, the plea is structured not to prosecute for further violations or other crimes in return for this pleading guilty to, in this case, his tax misdemeanors. This is usually an open and very transparent process in the court system. Instead, the Department of Justice and Hunter's lawyers effectively hid that part of the agreement and what was publicly described as a pre-trial diversion agreement relating to the gun charge against Hunter for being a drug user in possession of a firearm. So they put the facts in that plea agreement, but then they put their non-prosecution agreement in the pre-trial diversion agreement. Effectively, they were hiding the full scope of what the Department of Justice was offering and Hunter was obtaining through those proceedings. Hunter's upside from this deal was vast immunity from further prosecution if he finished a couple of years of probation, and the public wouldn't be any wiser because none of this was clearly stated on the face of the plea agreement, as would normally be the case. But Judge Norica, she smelled a rat. She understood that the lawyers were trying to paint her into a corner and hide the ball. Instead, she backed the Department of Justice and Hunter's lawyers into a corner by pulling all of the details out into the open and then indicating that she wasn't going to approve a deal as broad as what she had discovered. Bottom line, once again, the Biden crime family syndicate's lawyers tried to pull a fast one. And this time, they got caught. We'll see where it goes. Number three, the libs of TikTok posted a letter received from a follower. A pediatric clinic in Washington has revoked a parent's access to their kid's medical records when the kid turns 13 and says kids can make their own medical decisions. Now, we're seeing this all over. Progressives are now using this transgenderism, mass formation, psychosis, psyop to drive a wedge between parents and their children. They have openly told us in the past that our children are not our own, that in fact our children belong to the village. They are endeavoring to build a new generation of Hitler youth by any means necessary. So keep your eyes open for continued efforts in this regard and on a completely other front, as I've been talking a lot about lately, and that's the climate crisis. I guarantee you, as these new household appliance mandates start coming online, you know, updates on your stove, your air conditioner, your water heater, you can't have a gas-powered generator to power your home in a blackout, all of these things that they're trying to do right now. I promise you, and mark it down, you heard it here first, that they will start encouraging in schools for these children to start reporting their parents to the authorities if they haven't updated to the new approved models once these regulations start going into effect. And we just heard this week that they don't expect these mandates to go into effect until at least 2029. So, we have a couple of years left anyway before we start spending billions upon billions of dollars to update our homes to meet these new regulations related to the, the fraud that is climate crisis. Number four, oh, Canada. Look, it's no secret that I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson. Do I agree with every single word that he says? Of course not. I don't say that about anyone. I can't say that about anyone. But he, his podcasts, and his books have made me, I think, a better man. At least, I hope so. I've been able to take his lessons over the last several years, look back at the mistakes that I've made in my life, my adult life, and hopefully make meaningful course corrections. Honestly, that process continues. Now, as reported by Blaze Media yesterday, a regulatory group of Canadian psychologists has now ordered Jordan Peterson to undergo re-education programming after he expressed his opinions online. Now, rather than submit to the forced re-education scheme, Jordan Peterson, who no longer has a clinical practice in Canada, he actually intends, though, to maintain his clinical license, so he's elected to take the College of Psychologists of Ontario to court. But here's the problem. Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms is actually more akin to the old Soviet Constitution. I have an English language copy of the old Soviet Constitution that was ratified in 1977. The Soviets used to brag that they gave more rights to their citizens through their Constitution than did our Constitution and our Bill of Rights gave to us here in the United States. And in terms of the actual number of rights that they listed inside of their Constitution that were granted to them by the government, not inalienable rights, but you know what I mean, that claim was true. But all of those rights all came with a huge caveat. Namely, you had the right to free speech so long as that speech supported the advancement and the cause of Soviet socialism. That's what all the rights said in that constitution. In Canada, their courts are essentially now ruling in the same manner on speech. Canadians have the right to say whatever they wish, so long as it aligns with the approved governmental narrative. And it's no more complicated than that. And what about here in the United States? Where are we headed? Just this week, we have heard Democrats in congressional committee hearings arguing that certain speech, quote-unquote misinformation and malinformation, should be restricted. And believe me, they want to be the arbiters of what is acceptable or not. Even 2 weeks ago, a survey came out showing that 44% of Americans aged 25 to 34 think that referring to someone by the wrong gender pronoun should be a criminal offense. A criminal offense, not a mistake, not an accident, even if purposeful. A criminal offense for the words you use. It goes back to, you know, the Jordan Peterson thing. That's how he became famous. He refused to be mandated to call somebody by a particular gender and have the force of law behind that mandate. You've heard me say this over and over again. The assault on speech is the most dangerous, number one domestic threat that we now face in this country. keep your eyes and ears open. Okay, number five. This is the big topic of today, and I may go over by 10 minutes. I apologize. Some of you know that I've had access to that mysterious 41,000 hours of January 6th video. A smaller number of you are aware that some of that video is key to a couple of investigations that I've been working on for a long time, as much as 10 months. Almost every day now, someone asks me, when are we going to see what you have? Let me give you a little background first. To begin with, it's not really 41,000 hours of useful video, and this video that they refer to is specifically talking about the Capitol interior and exterior CCTV cameras, closed circuit television. That does not include all of the Metropolitan PD body cam footage that we've seen or the thousands of hours of personal cell phone footage that was captured that day by protesters and rioters alike. That 41,000 hour figure comes from a little over 1,700 cameras in and outside the Capitol during a 24 hour period. That's the math of how that works out. But in terms of actual usefulness and considering the timeline of what took place on January 6th, and what we're interested in, it's a lot less than 41,000 hours. Only about 9 a.m. that morning until about 6:30 p.m. is of real interest to most of us who are doing these investigations. So in reference to that 1,700 cameras at most, there's really not that much going on except for during those hours and in specific areas of the Capitol that really are of main interest. But I think you get the point of how this whole math thing works out. But I just wanted to clarify that before I went any further. Then there's the question of access. Let's be perfectly honest now. There are powers on the Hill who do not want this video out at all. They do not think that the public or the media have a right to this. There are others who still want all of it released to the public. Thank God they still exist on the Hill as well. And this was, of course, as McCarthy originally promised and has since backed off from. Then there's the lawsuit filed by the mainstream media coalition demanding equal access after Tucker Carlson's team was originally given exclusive access. To be honest, that's a fair demand, and I support them in that lawsuit. If the general public is not going to be given access, then all media sources need fair access to let America know what took place. But that's where the complications come in. Assuming they are never going to upload all that video to a publicly accessible server, the process of how staff having to administrate the access request and the scheduling and all of that, it's just a nightmare for them. And I'm just being honest from firsthand knowledge. Worse yet is then having to process the media requests for the specific videos found and wanted for their stories and broadcast because they have to be vetted for security concerns, so they say. Then they have to have the requested camera numbers and the timelines all transferred to a hard drive and then given to the journalists. And here's another kind of insider fact almost no one yet knows. They have used a limited number of independent journalists to learn and develop the process and procedures for how all of this is going to be done in the future. And that's before opening it up to the media at large. Now, this process obviously began with Tucker. It is also included John Solomon, Julie Kelly, Epoch Times, and then, of course, myself. To that end, I'm fortunate and thankful that I've been extended the opportunity to be one of those small handful of others that are, we're essentially been guinea pigs in the process. So to that end, I have been told, and this is directly from the source, that a published media guideline document is imminent any day now. Of course, as with all bureaucratic procedures and operations, they are running way behind on getting this done. It should also be noted that the media are not the only ones clamoring for access to all of this video. January 6th defendants, their legal teams, and other government investigators also have to be worked into those that are seeking time at these. There's only three terminals there where this access is granted. So this is going to be quite a scheduling process once they get this media guideline completed and finished. So that's just a little bit of background on how that is working. I certainly will be revealing more about this as I go forward with my own stories. So stay tuned. Okay, that's it for today. Please consider joining my locals community where I share content that I don't put out anywhere else. In fact, I'm talking a lot about those videos and issues there more than I am publicly up to this point. So please join us over there. It's free to subscribe, or for as little as $5 a month, you can help me in this process. I don't have a big media company paying my bills to do this. It's all on me and all in that small handful of supporters that helped me do this. I hope you can become one yourself. Just simply go to tpc4usa.com, tpc, the number 4usa.com, or from your app store, download the Locals app, and then search for at tpc4usa. You can also find me on Twitter, Facebook, and Truth Social with the same handle, at tpc4usa. Thanks so much, guys. I thank you for joining me on this 5 and 10. We'll do it again real soon.